Beginning 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the week of May 28, 2005, this is the Rain Report, Ham Radio's audio feature magazine of the Internet, also available via terrestrial dial-up at 847-827-RAIN. That's 847-827-7246 for the technologically challenged. I'm Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN. We'll bring you some observations about the just-completed Dayton Hamvention at the end of this week's program. Speaking of the Hamvention, we'll be bringing you excerpts from the FCC forum the next several weeks. The first two will be excerpts from a talk by William Cross, W3TN, an employee of the FCC in its Public Safety and Critical Infrastructure Division of the Commission's Wireless Bureau.
I'd like to talk about three different areas. First, I want to talk about a few commission decisions that have been made since we were here last year and that affect you all in some way. Second, I'll mention some items that are pending. And lastly, I want to mention issues that may be addressed in the future. The first item that's come out and that affects you all was something that came out of the managing director's office and was implemented last year. It is called the red light rule, and it is now in effect. If you go into ULS and click on ULS and look at an application, when the screen comes up on the application, you'll see a box at the bottom of it that says red light, and it'll say either yes or no. When we receive an application, one of the items we check for is whether an applicant owes the FCC money for anything. If you are delinquent in debts that are owed to the Commission, you will be ineligible to receive a license or other benefit until the delinquency has been paid in full or you have made arrangements for payment. If the debt hasn't been paid or arrangements made, your application will be dismissed. This is the red light rule. The rule is based on statutory changes adopted in the Debt Collection Improvement Act that Congress passed in 1996 and that has been implemented through rules adopted by the Department of the Treasury and Justice. A public notice on this rule was released last October, notifying you that we were going to start dismissing applications November 1st. Now, obviously, this only affects individuals who have delinquent debts owed the FCC. For hams, these debts typically are forfeitures that the Enforcement Bureau has assessed for some violation. The rule does affect other radio services, and this is why I'm mentioning it. I know that many of you have interests in land mobile services or, you know, other services the Commission also regulates, and the red light rule affects those services too. What it means in practice is that if someone has a delinquent debt and they apply for something, a vanity call sign, for example, a modification of the license such as an upgrade, or they apply to renew their license, we will send them a letter saying that they have to resolve the outstanding obligation or the application will be dismissed. If the application is dismissed, after you get the financial matter squared away, you may be able to refile depending on the rules for that particular service. The second decision affecting the amateur service came out March 16, 2005. This was a report and order in ET Docket 04139. This decision amended various parts of our rules to implement decisions from the 2003 World Radio Conference. It concerned frequency bands between 5,900 kHz and 27.5 GHz. For the amateur service, the report and order made some changes to the 7 MHz allocations in ITU Regions 1 and 3. In the band 7,000 to 7,100 kHz, the amateur and amateur satellite service have the primary allocation throughout the world. Effective January 1st of this year, the amateur service was elevated to co-primary status with the broadcasting service in the 7,100 to 7,200 segment of 40 meters in regions 1 and 3. ITU regions 1 and 3 primarily include Europe, Asia, Africa, and most of the Pacific. After March 29, 2009, this 100 kHz will be allocated to the amateur service on an exclusive basis throughout the world, except in certain countries. The except in certain countries condition means that we may still hear broadcast stations in our band after 2009, but there should be a lot fewer of them. What this means for us operationally is that amateur stations in many foreign countries may be heard transmitting in 7,100 to 7,200 kHz. I suspect that 10 years from now, we're still going to be hearing some YU calling CQ and someone else saying, you're out of the band. He's not. He's got a new band. If they can find a frequency that is not being used by an international broadcast station. From what I've read, a number of the European countries already have authorized their amateur stations to use this band. For our licensees, this report and order authorized amateur stations in regions 1 and 3 to transmit in the band 7100 to 7200 kHz. They were authorized SSB above 7150 and CW and digital emissions between 7100 and 7150, just as we have it here in the continental U.S. Primarily, this allocation benefits stations on a few of our Pacific islands. American Samoa, Guam, Northern Mariana, and Wake Island are the inhabited places because now they can operate SSB transceive with stateside stations between 7150 and 7200. This allocation also may help the expeditions that travel to our uninhabited Pacific islands. The third decision I wanted to mention was the Commission's report and order in ET Docket 0437. This is the broadband over power line, or the BPL proceeding. BPL systems may operate either inside a building, which is called in-house BPL, or over utility poles and medium voltage electric lines. This is access BPL. I couldn't get them to call it outhouse BPL as much as I tried. Electric utilities can, and some already do, use access BPL systems to monitor their electric power distribution operations. Licensed radio systems must be protected from harmful interference because BPL systems operate under Part 15 of the Commission's rules. In this docket, the Commission amended Part 15 to adopt new requirements and measurement guidelines for access BPL. As the FCC saw it, BPL offered the potential of another way to extend broadband access to American homes and businesses because power lines reach virtually every residence and business in this country. It also said access BPL could provide competition to existing cable, DSL, and other broadband services. Note that there are a lot of potentials and coulds here. Whether BPL catches on will be a decision made by economics, both for those who want to provide the service and consumers who have to decide it is better for them than other broadband services. Also note that BPL is coming on the scene, at best, as the fifth player in a field already crowded with heavy hitters. Currently, we have cable, satellite, non-satellite wireless broadband, and telephone lines available and providing broadband service. Fiber to the home, or the neighborhood pedestal, is what the telephone companies are looking at as a way of providing even greater bandwidth for communication services. I read Thursday that SBC, the local phone company here in the Midwest, wants to have fiber to the home to 50% of its customers in certain states in the next few years. The cable companies have been spending gazillions of dollars upgrading their systems to digital systems, so they can provide services other than traditional TV service. If your mailbox is like mine, these existing and working technologies are duking it out for my monthly communications dollar. They are packaging services every which way to Sunday. Internet access, cellular, long distance, and local telephone services, free features such as call forwarding, call waiting, caller ID, and all this stuff, cable TV services, satellite TV services, etc., and filling my mailbox with ads, come-ons, promos, and other junk mail. Advertising of this intensity indicates two things: healthy, robust competition between the existing service providers, and price cutting by them to get a bigger piece of what is essentially a fixed pot of dollars, unless they, the providers, can convince us, consumers, we need more.
You're listening to the first of dozens of forum excerpts you'll be hearing over the next year from the 2005 Dayton Hamvention. We'll continue with William Cross, W3TN's presentation from the FCC forum in a moment. This is the Rain Report.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for Rain audio.
Where does BPL fit in? I don't think anyone is getting a barrage of offers for services that are provided using BPL, nor will we be anytime soon from what I have read in the communications press. The Commission recognized that the concern of many radio users both private and government users, with BPL is interference, and the need to ensure that RF energy from signals on power lines does not cause harmful interference to licensed radio services. If you think for a moment that the federal government made this decision in a vacuum because it could not be affected by BPL itself, this is absolutely incorrect. There are over 18,000 federal government frequency assignments between 1.7 and 80 megahertz. These are assignments that are to agencies including the FAA, the intelligence agencies, and defense agencies. Even us, the FCC, have allocations in there. There also are safety of life services in that frequency segment. The Marine Services are in there for high frequency communications. There is spectrum set aside for aircraft that is flying internationally. And there's a whole bunch of other services in there too. So what the Commission did in its decision was it tried to provide a framework that it believed will both facilitate the introduction and development of BPL systems and would protect licensed radio services from harmful interference. The Commission adopted a tremendous number of new requirements for BPL. They include new operational requirements for access BPL to promote avoidance and resolution of harmful interference, new administrative requirements to aid in identifying access BPL installations, and specific measurement guidelines and certification requirements to ensure accurate and repeatable evaluations of emissions from access BPL and all other carrier current systems. It also required certification of BPL equipment, a higher standard than verification or declaration of conformity. The Commission also excluded certain bands of frequencies throughout the HF spectrum from access BPL operation, including operation within 1 kilometer of over 100 different Coast Guard facilities around the country, including some in major cities. The Commission established land areas within which access BPL operation is not permitted in certain frequency bands, and it required consultation between an entity operating access BPL and a public safety licensee at least 30 days prior to initiation of operation. A public database containing information regarding existing and planned systems is also required. The Commission also required adaptive interference mitigation techniques, such as notch filtering, or complete avoidance of frequencies or bands of frequencies in order to avoid site-specific local use of spectrum that is authorized licensed radio services. For frequencies below 30 megahertz, when a notch filter is used, attenuation of at least 20 dB below the applicable Part 15 limit is required. Above 30 megahertz, attenuation of at least 10 dB below the applicable Part 15 limit is required. The Commission also required a remote controllable shutdown feature to deactivate any unit causing harmful interference if other interference mitigation techniques do not resolve the problem. You look at this list of what was required to go into this, and you wonder, with all these restrictions, including that prohibit BPL deployment in what appears to be some very profitable areas, a reasonable question might be, who would want to go into this business? There still seem to be 3 or 4 companies that are interested, and they think the restrictions that the Commission imposed are too onerous, and they have asked to reconsider some of these restrictions. I read that one of them, a potential database manager, was whining about the 30-day notice requirement because it would allow other broadband providers to know where they were going to start operating. And their objection was, get this, it would allow those other operators to cut prices in that area. Gee, doesn't that affect the profitability of BPL? The ARRL and other groups do not think the restrictions go far enough. They, too, have asked for reconsideration. Those petitions are pending, and whatever is decided on them may affect the final rules for BPL and may very well affect its viability. Then, there are state regulatory issues to be addressed, too. Many states have not yet considered using power lines for other purposes, and how electric ratepayers should be compensated for their use, if at all. And there has been some congressional interest in BPL, too. A resolution has been introduced calling for the FCC to conduct further analysis of the radio interference from broadband over power line. The bottom line of all this is that there is still a lot of uncertainty surrounding BPL. its technical and financial viability, where, how, and if it will fit into the communications future.
You've just heard the first of two excerpts we'll be bringing you from the 2005 Dayton Hamvention Talk by William Cross, W3TN, an employee of the Public Safety and Critical Infrastructure Division of the FCC's Wireless Bureau. Cross will be back with more of his FCC update next time. Now some observations about the Dayton Hamvention, which wrapped up this past Sunday, May 22nd. For the first time in recent memory, the Hamvention was not deluged with rain. That's with a small r. Having said that, a significant number of outdoor flea market and indoor exhibit booths were empty. However, with the recently implemented and much improved organization, coupled with a return to an all-volunteer show, hopefully this trend will reverse itself next year. Other than an unusually high number of technical glitches, Rain's founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, brought home hours of potentially useful forum recordings like the one you heard this week. Just an editorial note about those glitches, folks need to learn to notify the forum chair ahead of time of their need to interface laptop computers to the in-house audio systems in the forum rooms for use in multimedia presentations and not simply unplug a recording device that is deemed less important. Too many egos and not enough auxiliary inputs. Okay, enough said. Special thanks go out to the following for helping to make the weekend a success. In no particular order, ladies first. Leanne Main, KB9ZEF. Paula Gross. Stephanie Holly, KA9WKD. Dottie Jackson, KG0VN. And Shirley Roberts, N8LX. Their male counterparts included Vern Jackson, WA0RCR. Blair Alper, KA9SEQ. Dave Gross, KF9AV. Byron Lee, KC9EEK, Lynn Roberts, N8LK, Stacy from ITA Inc., Cassette Services, Mark Davis from Madman Productions, and last and most importantly, General Hamvention Chair Gary DeCombs, N8EMO, and his staff. On a personal note, Hap and Stephanie very much enjoyed having lunch following the Hamvention with Shirley and Lynn Roberts. In addition, the Hollies, as always, were delighted to have their annual Lebanon, Indiana, Din Din, both en route to and driving back from the Hamvention with Merle Heinlein, KB9NOH. Merle interviewed Hap a few years back on his Danville, Illinois 2-meter repeater net, the first time Hap recalls being interviewed on a repeater live. That interview will eventually find its way into the Rain Collection. Oh, speaking of which, we'll give you ordering info about Volume 1 of the Rain Collection MP3 CD when time permits. Speaking of time, we're out of it for this week. That's 30 for the Rain Report. Copyright 1990 through 2005 Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN.